determinations are the permanent control, and I give the floor to Julia.
Thank you, Hans. Good morning, everyone. I will make a brief introduction, and then I will hand over to Anna. So the purpose of this meeting is to remind you where we are in the project, what work we have done, and also provide you an overview of what is coming in the next month. Our expectation is that the next milestone in the project will be a discussion paper, and so in the coming months we will be asking you about which alternatives should be included in the discussion paper and whether you would like to express a preliminary view on some of the topics. There are three main topics we would like to talk you through at this meeting: the scope of the project, which methods could be applied for a business combination under common control, and also the application of the predecessor method. Before we move to those topics, a few words about the background. So the project was first added on the ISB research agenda in 2012. In 2014, the board made a tentative decision about the scope of the project. Following that decision, we performed research and outreach in order to understand how business combinations under common control are accounted for in practice, and also what are the views on how they should be accounted for. Last year, following 2015 agenda consultation, the project was confirmed on the research agenda, and so we're resuming the discussion. So what are the issues? If you look at slide 7, in a business combination, the acquiring entity recognizes assets and liabilities of the acquired entity at fair values in accordance with the acquisition method set out in IFRS 3. However, business combinations under common control are scoped out from IFRS 3, and as a result, in some cases, entities use the acquisition method by analogy to IFRS 3 and record acquired assets liabilities at fair values. In some other cases, entities use the so-called predecessor method, and under that method, they recognize acquired assets and liabilities at their historical carrying amounts. There is also diversity in how the predecessor method is applied, and so interested parties expressed concerns about this diversity in practice. We have included a couple of examples in the slide deck just to illustrate the issue. So if you look at slide 8, suppose you are a non-controlling shareholder in entity A. In the first scenario, entity A acquires entity B. A and B are controlled by different parties. So as a result, a non-controlling shareholder in entity A will see fair values of assets and liabilities of entity B. A similar scenario, you are a non-controlling shareholder in entity A. A acquires B. However, both A and B are controlled by the same party. So this is business combination under common control. It's scoped out from IFRS 3. And you can either see assets and liabilities of entity B at their historical carrying amounts or at their fair values. So you will get different information for what can be a similar transaction. And this diversity can be even greater in an IPO scenario. So if you look at slide 9, so here the information that you will get will depend on what sort of reorganization happened before the IPO and what method is applied to account for such reorganization. So suppose here we have a privately held group and the controlling party P decides to sell A and B in an IPO. So in the first case, suppose P decides to use the acquisition method to account for the reorganization. If A acquires B, then as a public shareholder, you will get historical carrying amounts for A and fair values for B. If, on the other hand, B acquires A, then you will get historical information for B and fair value information for A, although you are investing in the same set of assets and liabilities in the same business. If B decides to use the predecessor method, then you will get historical information for assets and liabilities of both entity A and entity B. So these are the issues we are looking to address in this project. Before we move to detailed questions, do you have any general question about about the project.
Just out of curiosity, does the US GAAP have the same free choice, or?
They use the predecessor method.
Across the board?
Yeah.
Yulia, can I, just a quick question, and this is, I think, much more of a reminder than anything else. There are, in some of the literature I've seen anyway, there are reasons why different methods might make sense under different circumstances. For example, the existence of NCI or not might change the view on which method makes more sense because you're catering to a different set of users in that case. Did we see during the early views we had of diversity that there was a pattern of which choice people used, or was it simply just diverse period?
We haven't been able to identify any meaningful trend. I think it's fair to say that in most cases, entities use the predecessor method. In some cases, the acquisition method is also used. It's more rare, but it's used. But as I said, we haven't seen a particular pattern when it is the case.
Another question about acquisition accounting. When we see it, and I'm crossing my fingers the answer is yes, do we see people applying IFRS 3, you know, the current version of IFRS 3 with full fair value, or do we also see some instances of more what I'd call purchase price allocation, which wouldn't necessarily fair value? It would, you know, it would attribute the amount paid, but it wouldn't remeasured to fair value.
We haven't seen such an application.
Okay. So we haven't seen the old IFRS, you know, IFRS 3.
Yeah. So it's either the acquisition method as set out in IFRS 3 or
now. Okay.
Historical value.
That's good.
Yeah. And if you could just help me just clarify from my position the impact of going down these different routes impacts the performance statement, financial position, but doesn't impact the cash flow statement. Or can it impact the cash flow statement?
Reconciling items, I guess.
Yes, and I'm also thinking about what you do with comparative information.
But on a go-forward basis, it may do in the year the transaction is consummated, but on a go-forward basis, would it affect the cash flow?
I wouldn't have thought so.
Okay, just helpful for me to get one.
If you're doing reconciliation, you're adding back depreciation if you stepped up.
In terms of totality, yeah. Of the cash flows and some of the components, yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Okay, we can move then to the scope section. So from slide 10 to slide 17. And while refreshing our memories on the scope of the project, I'll just flag a couple of considerations for you to consider in future deliberations. So when talking about the scope, we need to clarify on one side the accounting of which transaction is considered by the project, and on the other side, at what level we are looking at these transactions. So in other words, from what entity perspective we are looking at these transactions. So on slide 11, we consider the first side of the scoping exercise, so which transaction to consider. And to help you understand better the scope of the decision, we prepare a very simple matrix. So a transaction might be classified as concluded between entities not under common control, so the left side of the matrix, or concluded between entities under common control, so the right side of the matrix. And a further classification would be between transaction involving the transfer of a business and transaction not involving the transfer of a business. And of course, when I talk about business and under common control, I mean them with the exact same meaning as defined or described in IFRS standard. So as you can see from this matrix, the entire left side of the matrix is covered. So the accounting of the transaction on the left side of the matrix covered by either IFRS 3 when it comes to a transaction involving the transfer of business or applicable standard. If we regarding the right side, so the top quadrant of the matrix is equally covered by the applicable IFRS standard, because the only scope exclusion related to transaction between entity under common control is the one contained in IFRS. So this leaves us with identifying as not covered but by any IFRS standard, those transactions that are in the grey oval in slide 11. So transactions that involve the transfer of business and that are concluded between the entity and the common control.
Who has a question?
An observation, maybe. So you've got your little asterisk here, which was our hope. And unfortunately, at the Interpretation Committee last week, we didn't manage to finalise the agenda decision. And it's maybe just worth flagging that I think a number of people who wrote to us encouraged us to include within the scope of this project these transactions involving associates, because there was some difference of opinion about whether or not sort of indirectly the scope exclusion in IFRS 3 did apply in IAS 28. So the reading of them is a monitor paragraph. So I'm not sure that I agree that we should expand the scope, but it's probably fair to acknowledge that some are questioning that.
On this point,
yes,
thank you. I heard that there was a discussion in the IFRIC meeting. Could you kindly explain what kind of discussion we had in the IFRIC meeting and quickly, you know,
Sue is probably best position to do so.
So I think there was a general agreement in the Interpretation Committee meeting that you can't sort of apply by analogy a scope across IFRS standards because of IFRS 3. Look at you guys to make sure you think I'm not misspeaking.
Yeah.
But there's a paragraph in IAS 28 which talks about the fact that you should apply the procedures that are set out for consolidation when you apply the equity method.
Yeah.
And some people think that when they read the words procedures there, yeah, that doesn't just mean how you sort of do the debits and credits, but by implication it also feeds in the scope parameters that come in with a consolidation scenario, including the scope exclusion for IFRS 3. So there were some differences of opinion around that, and so that was sort of, we didn't manage to close that issue at the committee.
So does it mean that there are some constituents who are using predecessor method even for the common control under acquisition of
associates
under common control?
That's the implication.
That's the implication, yes. Because I think it was acknowledged that there is diversity of application, and I think that is because some are doing that. So it's an open question that the committee didn't manage to close.
I'm kind of straddling my role as one of the board advisors, board observers of the Interpretation Committee, and thinking about the scope of this project. I think maybe let's wait till we get the kind of finalize the Interpretation Committee update and, you know, get the full report from that out. But I think first reaction in terms of if that discussion kind of leaves the question about the top right quadrant, there are two ways that we could address this within the scope. One is to say we also need to start from scratch in terms of developing what our concepts are around associates, or the other is to look more narrowly at the question of, do we think that paragraph in IS 28 should bring the common control exclusion to associates? I think the second one is a much narrower project that doesn't create tremendous scope creep, for the common control project. So, just a marker to think about what it means to say put it within the scope of this project. It could be, depending upon what the board decides, something as limited as a clarifying amendment.
Okay.
Maybe just one quick observation on the scope from me as well. So when the board made its decision in 2014, we actually consulted with interested parties, and in particular we consulted with the ASAF on the scope of the project. And the prevailing message that we heard was focus of the narrow set of transactions that I excluded from IFRS 3 and pretty much do it as quickly as possible, as opposed to look at all related party transactions or a broader set of related party transactions, because that would obviously take much longer. So that was the message that we've heard in this project.
Okay. Moving to the second side of the exercise, what level we are looking at the transactions, so moving to slide 12. If we think about a common business combination and the common control, so as the one illustrated on the slide, where there is an entity A which is controlled by entity P, and this entity acquire entity C from another entity B, and B is also controlled by the same party, so entity B. So when we look at the after situation, the question is, what happened at the parent level? So at the parent level, so P, entity P still control entity C, and since there are non-controlling interests in entity A, when entity A acquired entity C, the parent entity disposed a 30% interest in entity C to those non-controlling interests. But however, this transaction is already covered. The accounting of this transaction is already covered by requirement in IFRS 10, so we don't need to worry about this transaction. Now, if we look at the seller level, so entity B, what happened? Entity B disposed its subsidiary and entity C. So it, once again, this transaction is also already covered by IFRS 10 requirement. And finally, if we look at the acquiree level, what happened at this level? I would say nothing, apart from the fact that entity C is now directly controlled by entity A instead of entity B, and according to the disclosure requirement in IS 24, it has to disclose the new controlling party. So these leave us with the acquirer level, and actually the accounting of this transaction at the acquirer level, so in the acquirer's financial statement, is not covered by IFRS standard. So the project focuses on the information needs of the primary user of the acquirer financial statement. And all these considerations, so regarding the transaction and regarding the entity, were reflected in the scope decision that the board made in June 2014, which is reported on slide 13. So in its tentative decision, the board decided that the project should consider business combination under common control that are excluded from the scope of IFRS 3, group restructuring, and also the need to clarify the description of business combination under common control, including the meaning of common control. And a consideration that we want to bring to your attention today is, moving to slide 14, is that the term group restructuring is not a defined term, and might be used differently by different parties. So we need to be very careful in using this term. As you can see in this slide, some people consider group restructuring as being just those transfer of business between entity under common control. There are not business combination under common control. So the gray area on the right side of the oval. But some other people give the term a broader meaning. So for them, group restructuring are all the transaction between entity under common control that involve the transfer of a business, and this transaction might or might not meet definition of business combination under common control. But let's look at some example to clarify this. So on slide 15, we presented a very simple starting situation. So we have entity A and entity B, both controlled by same parents. Entity A controls entity C, and entity B controls entity D. There are non-controlling interests in entity A. Our focus, as previously discussed, is of course on the acquirer's financial statement. So we are looking at this transaction at A level. So in example one, entity A acquires entity D from entity B, and from a scoping perspective, this is a business combination under common control. And we can see that the economic position of entity A actually changed because it now controls not just C, but also entity D. A similar situation is in example two. So in here, entity A acquires entity B directly from the parent. Again, from a scoping perspective, this is a business combination under common control. And once again, A economic position changed. But now, if we move to slide 16, so we are starting with the same exact situation as in the previous slide, and we are still looking at the A level. So in example three, we have entity A that demerges one of its business into a new reform entity and retain control over it. So from a scoping perspective, this is not a business combination of the common control. And my question is, do we really need to worry about this transaction? So does a economic position change? I would say no, because it still controls the same exact two business as it controlled before. And a very similar situation is in example four. So in here, entity P is, again, a newly created entity controlled by entity A that now controls directly entity C. Once again, from a scoping perspective, this is not a business combination under common control. And once again, A economics position arguably doesn't change. But the point we are trying to make with this example, that is also reflected on the next slide, so on the next step slide, is that the board might need to discuss further what transactions are included in the scope of the project. In other words, just business combination under common control, so example one and two, or a broader group of transactions. And as reported in slide 17, in October, we plan to start discussing with you transactions that are included in the scope of the project, whether there is a need to clarify the meaning of common control, and we will also provide you an overview of a related project and related agenda decision. I will now pause before moving to the next section to in case you have any consideration or question to share. And of course, this is not a deliberation session, it's an education session, so we are not asking you to decide.
Don't argue, just be educated.
So another question just to clarify my memory, I guess. I'm looking at slide 12. I am correct if I say that the P in 12, the parent in slide 12, does not have to be an IFRS compliant entity, and in fact it doesn't need to even be an entity in the way it's been interpreted. Okay, and then just on 13, when we talked about the tentative decisions, the bullet right at the bottom, again, recollection, NCI would be one of those external parties we would be considering. We said it affects, okay. Yeah.
just on slide 16, sorry, the question is, does A's economic position change? It seems to me that if A's spending this money on lawyers and stuff and doing all this restructuring but maintaining full control, it's likely the first step to something else. Like, I'm not sure what the economic advantage of creating, you know, legal entities is. So when we look at this, do we need to think about why they might be doing it and what might be coming next?
Probably the correct wording is A, economic position doesn't change yet, but this kind of transaction might be a transaction in preparation of an IPO, for instance, if I want to sell C1.
So that's what I'm sort of asking is, if we look at the possible things coming down the road, does it matter what they are? The way we think about this.
That's about intent, almost, rather than about point in time.
I would agree. I would agree. It's about intent, but I just don't. Depending where it's going, we want to make sure that the accounting doesn't lead us to a bad place when they get there. without knowing where they're going.
We will definitely look at all of that in the future paper on the scope, future papers on the scope, rather. I think the main message in this slide, I'd like to reiterate the yes. So in situations 3 and 4, there is basically almost no transaction to account for. Nothing was sold, nothing was acquired. Essentially, A maintains control over C. Just, for example, in situation 3, C used to be in one legal shell, now this business is in two legal shells. In example 4, there was a direct control, and now there is an intermediary holding company, but in terms of the business that A controls, nothing has changed. That's the main message we were trying to get across here.
Gary. I know Yuli, it's been a long time since we discussed this. Just want to confirm, this entire discussion or project, I think in all, if or almost all cases, we're not talking about changes at the P level. I mean, if there's any
correct
remeasurement or adjustments in the subsidiaries that would get eliminated or somehow would not make its way up to P for group reporting at the P level, correct?
Correct, yes.
And I think an example three, and then, you know, try to give a partial answer to Tom. First of all, I think group restructurings, movement stuff happens all the time. And you're right, maybe A's collective position doesn't change, but I could give you a very common example. So let's say A is operating in any country, and you've got an established workforce, C, and you're going to want to expand your lines of business to do something different. You really don't want to commingle the workforces. So you create entity C, and you start doing something because you create entity C1 to put your new lines of business in there. You just say entity C has got work councils, and you think this new line of business would not need them. You've never combined workforces, and then so I think it's very much enabler to expanding the bulk of business that you do, but for different reasons you don't want to mingle workforces, pension plans, tax returns, or whatever. But still at the A level, nothing has changed. But there's lots of good reasons why you would do this. Without positioning for an IPO or anything else.
Mary?
I'm also asking a question about slide 16, and I think related to Tom's question, but a bit different perspective. One of the reasons we decided to prioritize this project for our active research agenda was concern of regulators, as you noted earlier on, about transactions in capital markets. And I agree with your analysis in example four in particular. Sorry, I'm focusing on example four. I agree with your analysis that from the perspective of A, it's not a business combination under common control. Good with that. But I think the question is, that we should go back to the regulators who asked us to look at this project and prioritize BC under common control and make sure that the transactions in which, let's say, P1 is distributed or sold in an IPO, and the question is, what is the basis in P1? Is that a small proportion of the problematic transactions or a big proportion of the problematic transactions? Because if it turns out that the structure, transactions with the structure of subsequently distributing or selling P1 are the majority of the problematic situations that they're seeing, the scope of the project that we have will fail to address, the bulk of their issues. And I think I just want to know that before I make a final scope decision. I would like personally as to keep it as tight a project as possible, to partly for speed, partly because I think you're correct in the analysis of what is a business combination, but I think we need to make sure that we have a handle so that it can be an informed decision about how tight or how broad we do.
And just to be clear, because I think your observation comes back to which level we are looking at, all we're saying here in slide four that essentially A does not need to be in the scope of the project in this scenario because nothing happens for A. But for P1, arguably it's a different story,
right?
Because now this newly created entity has a business that is controlled. Now there might be a question whether it's a business combination under common control or not, if P is just a legal shell.
Yeah.
But I'd like to emphasize that all we're saying here that for A nothing happens.
I agree with you that for A, nothing has happened and there isn't really an accounting question at A. But I think there is, or there may be, an accounting question at the P1 level.
Yes.
And understanding whether understanding how frequent the P1 level transactions are and whether they're also problematic is one piece of information I'm after. And then if it turns out it's a frequent transaction, I think, thinking through what the implications of our VCUCC conclusions are for P1. You know, it may not be a business combination, because it may be in substance C, acquiring not a business. But I think, you know, let's make sure that we're addressing the right target.
Chung-Woo.
Thank you. On page 12, generally the analysis is very clear and are very good to understand all the issues. On page 12, the league suggests a very fundamental question whether there is some kind of cash flow effect on these transactions. So if you see page 12, they are in terms of the group of parent, that group, and the NCI. NCI, in terms of these two groups, there might be some cash flow effect, right? Not just the perspective of A, just from the perspective of P, including every group, NCI, these are a little different interest groups. So there might be some wealth transfer effect and maybe some kind of cash flow effect. So that's why if there is the existence of NCI might affect our accounting solution. So that's based on the Nick's excellent comment whether there is the cash flow effect to the group.
I agree with your sort of conclusion, I think, on page 16 that these aren't business combinations under common control. I think Tom's comment is a useful reminder that we need to sort of make sure that there isn't some way you could get a different outcome by doing this first and then something else second, and that's probably a good sort of reasonableness check. But I think we need to be careful. There'd be lots of reasons why you might be interested in the fact that this has happened and there could be disclosures and other consequences you'd care about if you were an A, if some of these things had gone on. So, for example, depending on what debt goes into C1 and, you know, what jurisdictions are involved and tax and all sorts of things, there could be implications for A's investors in the NCI in terms of how cash can flow in the group and all those sorts of things. But that's not a business combination under common control thing. So I think we need to be careful not to sort of start thinking, oh, there's lots of things we care about, therefore it should be scoped in. So that's why I would agree with your sort of gut reaction, it's not this project.
Yeah. Martin.
Yeah, a short question on slide 12. The project focuses on the information needs of the primary users of acquirers' financial statements. I would agree to that, but do we have to have the focus a little bit different from what we do in the usual things, because when one of the current investors or the owners is against the parent, and I think the parent information needs about the financials of the acquirer A is not, should not be in the focus. Maybe the focus is of the NCI and maybe future investors in that. So I think a little bit kind of who is the primary user, really, of this financial statements of A should be focusing a little bit different as we have done it usually.
Just as a follow-up to that, I think one other thing we need to remember is that the primary users are not just the equity investors. I think in these discussions we tend to focus a lot on the equity investors, but it's also the other, the lenders and other creditors as well, and we need to just think about that as we go on.
In slide 12, to what extent is there consolidation within this group, in the after group with P? Are there consolidated accounts of this group?
Not necessarily.
And what would dictate whether there were consolidated accounts for the after group?
They were a reporting entity.
So
if it was a government, for example, there might not be consolidated.
So it'll depend on each jurisdiction.
And who the owner
is. The type of the controller. Yeah. Can be a private person.
So we're not, when we talk about these information users for A, we're not really clear about how they get their information, whether the accounts for A are clear for them or whether there's consolidation. So their information of A has to come via P.
I think we're assuming that the financial statements of A, which after the transaction would be consolidated financial statements, are used by primary users of financial statements. We're just
okay. We're assuming that A has some financial statements that are accessible to these users. C has been consolidated in there, but A is not consolidated into P.
May or may not
be. So we've got two different scenarios which would really affect how we think about the information, because we're talking about the information needs of these primary users for A, but we're not really sure how visible they're going to be, because is it A presenting the information, or is that A information then rolled up and consolidated into P?
I think we're assuming A's are sort of general purpose available IFRS financial statements. I think is our assumption.
Yeah.
I think the only question is around whether P would have consolidated financial statements, but I think we're assuming A would.
Yeah. I think the whole question becomes irrelevant if A is not using preparing IFRS accounts, because then they wouldn't listen to us anyway.
Yeah.
It's essentially we would be writing something for the A's that are preparing IFRS.
Exactly. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Chen Chao. Just to give a very simple example, for example, Bank of China, it is the listed company, and actually the biggest stakeholder, the parent, is Ministry of Finance of China. So Ministry of Finance of China will not consolidate Bank of China. Would they need just every year's dividends distributed to the Ministry of Finance? This is the main economic cash flow we need. But the Bank of China, because this is in Hong Kong and this is in Shanghai Stock Exchange, so those other investors, they need public financial information. And if the Bank of China acquire another company which has been controlled by maybe Ministry of Finance or maybe its own subsidiaries, so what kind of accounting they need that the Bank of China should need? So this is the question when the issue come out. Yeah.
I'll move quickly to the second section, so research and outreach, which is actually just one slide. So the staff, as Julia said before, have performed a range of outreach and a range of research activity with different types of interest parties, so users, regulators, standard setter, and preparer and accounting firm. And those activities mainly focus on two topics. So topic one, first question is, which methods are applied in practice to account for business combination under common control, and which methods should be applied to account for business combination under common control? And this is like the first question. The second question is, how the predecessor method, which appears to be the most commonly used method in practice, again, is applied in practice and should be applied to provide useful information about business combination under common control. And I'll just add a couple of considerations here. I will go through the actual feedback on topic one and topic two at the beginning of the next two sections. This slide is just about what we ask, what we focus on. And the second consideration is that we added to this paper, to this presentation, the agenda paper that were presented in April 2016 to the board. And this paper provides a better overview of all the research and outreach that the staff performed, as well as of the feedback received. But of course, if you have any question on how we structure these activities and these outreach, please feel free to ask. Now, otherwise, I will move to the next topic. Okay, let's move it. So, next section. The question is, what are the methods for accounting business combination under common control? And the key message we receive from our outreach is that there is both diversity in practice in how business combination under common control are accounted for, and also different views on how business combination should be accounted for. And regarding what happened in practice, respondent reported us that in practice, business combination under common control are typically accounted for using the predecessor method. But as Julia said, some participants reported also that in few cases the acquisition method has also been used. Whereas regarding what methods should be applied to account for business combination under common control, once again, many interested parties supported using the predecessor method as a default method of accounting, but users have different views on whether the predecessor method or the acquisition method would provide most useful information. Right, some regulators ask the board to consider whether there are some circumstances in which the acquisition method or even the so-called fresh start accounting is not applicable. And finally, some standard setters suggested that maybe different methods might be most appropriate in different circumstances, and they suggested the board to establish a conceptual basis for determining how to report business combination. So to recap, the potential alternative methods that we identify are outlined in slide 23. So we have predecessor method, acquisition method, and fresh start accounting. And to refresh our memories, according to the predecessor method, net assets of all combining entities should be measured at the historical carrying amount, and this is the method most commonly used in practice. Regarding the acquisition method, net assets of the acquired entity should be measured at fair value, and this is exactly the same method required by IFRS 3 for business combination, not under common control. But what we like to highlight here is that the real choice seems to be between the first two methods, so predecessor method and acquisition method, not the fresh start accounting, which require net asset of all combining entity measured at fair value. And this is because although the fresh start accounting was mentioned during our outreach, this method has no real basis under the existing requirement in IFRS standard. And let me explain what I mean by this. So the predecessor method is based on entity carried amount, and these amounts are those amounts recorded applying IFRS standard. Whereas the acquisition method is the same method provided in IFRS 3, but there are no requirements that allow or require an entity to replace its net asset carrying amount with fair value after an acquisition of another entity. So this is why the fresh start accounting in this slide is added for completeness, but is not a real choice for us.
Ms. Rosa?
It's just a question of education for me. I mean, and not being a proponent necessarily of the fresh start method, but I'm surprised that you would say that the fresh start method is not in compliance with the conceptual framework. But I mean, if you don't have any requirements, you can refer to the conceptual framework, and I don't see what in the conceptual framework would prevent the fresh start.
It will be a new method, a completely new method. I'm not saying it's not in compliance with the conceptual framework. What I say is that there are no requirements or no requirement in the actual IFRS standard literature except for you.
So it would be permitted, but it says not permitted. But that was what I was questioning.
But the assets and liabilities of the acquirer would just be covered by the normal standards. So, for example, the fixed assets will be covered by IS 16, and I don't think you'd find a basis for restating them to fair value just because you'd acquired another entity.
So, I mean, the important point about the fresh start is what you're doing is you are revaluing previously recognized assets.
Right.
Yeah. Not just the assets that you're acquiring through, but previously recognized.
Of the acquirer.
Of the acquirer. And it's those previously recognized assets that are arguably already under the ambit of existing standards.
Amaro.
Thanks, Ms. Thank you for the presentation so far. On slide 21, it's just for the sake of clarification. The second point, you mentioned that many interested parties support using the predecessor method as a default. So, and then in 22, you expand a little bit, making reference to users, regulators, and standard setters. So what can we understand as the default method? Is that some of them do support having option?
So I think the sort of message that we got in the outreach that we performed some interested parties we talked to just said use predecessor method for everything, full stop. Some said, well, maybe the predecessor method should be used in most cases. So this is your starting point. Normally use a predecessor method, but if specific conditions are met, maybe for those transactions you should use the acquisition method.
But they're limited to these two methods.
Yes, and as Anna mentioned, there were probably a couple of respondents we talked to who said, think about fresh start accounting. Maybe there is some place for fresh start accounting, but it was literally just a couple of suggestions. Normally, interested party were focused on predecessor method or a combination of predecessor and acquisition method.
Mary?
A thought and a question. The thought is, going back to Francoise's point about fresh start, I'm not an advocate of fresh start or doing a lot of work on it, but I guess I'm a bit concerned by the basis that we do some informal outreach, and because it isn't popular, we decide not to pursue it. I think the point that was raised, I can't remember who said it, about the inconsistency with existing IFRS about revaluing because of a controlled transaction all the existing assets is an immediate conceptual barrier. So it might just be helpful to put it to bed once and for all by bringing back a paper that analyzes it and thinks about whether there's any information value for users that would allow us to have a bit more formalized assessment of that option before killing it off. But I think, you know, from a project management perspective, good to say there are three alternatives identified. Here's our analysis that knocks out one, and do it that way. And then that gives us a basis for including that in a discussion paper, say. Back to the predecessor method. Do you know that if the amount paid for an acquiree differs from the carrying value of the acquiree, that there's no adjustment of the carrying value for that difference? I would imagine that if there was a difference, I paid 100 for something that had a book value of 80, that the 20 difference would, if you were carrying over all the values, have to be recorded as some kind of capital transaction. And I guess, do we have any insight that is what happens, or does predecessor method and the cost notion perhaps include the notion of accounting for the book value 80 transactions based on the 100 paid by the acquirer?
So we have a set of slides which discuss specifically how the predecessor method is applied. So we'll look at it in a few minutes. Short answer is that if there is a difference between what you record as a historical carrying amount and what you pay, so this difference gets recognized in equity, and we haven't really seen, well, there is diversity in where in equity it is recognized, but it always goes to equity.
Okay, maybe I remember it from this slide.
I was just going to say something similar, so is it okay if I just follow on? Sorry to jump in. If you didn't give me all of the details that were in this book, and I was starting with a clean sheet of paper, just thinking about how to account for one of these transactions, and if I had a situation where, as Mary said, I had consideration paid for the transaction of 100, and then I come along and I've got all of these assets and liabilities that I've now acquired, to be common control, but I acquired them. My natural inclination would be to think about our normal requirements, and if I normally bought something for 100, usually I book it a carrying amount of 100. Not, you know, I wouldn't care what the acquiree, you know, what the carrying amount was for the person who I bought it from, because I'm accounting for my acquisition of those assets. So what I would be interested when we get into the thinking of the project to understand is, from a conceptual basis, why, even though everybody seems to like it, and I think I understand how the mechanics work, what is it that's sort of justifying that logic? Because to me, it's an odd logic just from first principles that, because, you know, Peter's got on his books for 80, even though I paid 100 for it, I'm going to say, well, because Peter had it for 80, I'll have it for 80. Now, I wonder whether it's because it's all tied up with, are these really arm's length prices? People are nervous about the valuations and all of that sort of stuff. But for me, that's a secondary consideration, because I'd like to think first about sort of first principles, what's my concept, and then stop and think about, well, how comfortable am I applying it in these circumstances. But it's a two-step process, because I'm a bit nervous about sort of for the similar reasons that Mary raised about, let's not just say people don't do fresh start, so therefore we're not going to do fresh start. Similarly, I don't want us to say, well, everybody does predecessor, therefore we should think about doing predecessor, until I've thought through the logic of what's the concept, then is there something special I need to do because of the facts and circumstances that tend to be around these types of transactions, and sort of think it through that logically. I may then get to predecessor, but I'd like to do it with my own logic as opposed to everyone loves this, so it must be great.
Well, and maybe just following up on that line of thought, I mean, what people aren't doing, I guess, in the predecessor method is recognising any goodwill. But in principle, there's no reason why you couldn't. You're still acquiring the goodwill. But in this case, the measurement would be even more influenced by other factors, because you'd have all the valuation differences that would be in there as well.
There's the goodwill point, which, you know, I agree with you, but even more simply, assume I just pay exactly the fair value of net assets. Why am I worrying about what the carrying amount was of the seller?
Okay. John?
Yeah. I think the underlying concept and the theory is very important to help us to move forward this project. But it seems that we have different perspective. If from the reporting entity perspective, what kind of accounting we need, or if we look at just from the separate financial statement. Because I'm a parent, this is my big brother, and this is the oldest son, and this is the younger son. And the older son pay $100 buy something from the younger son. And the book value on the younger son is $80. It seems then the assets on the older son will be 100, and the younger son, they will make $20 profit. And then his asset value will increasing from 80 to 100. So if we just simply based on fair value, the assets has been increasing from 180 to $200 US dollars. But from parents, from whole families, this is the reporting entity. Actually, there is no any value increase. They just transfer the assets from one pocket to another pocket. So from individual side, the younger son say, okay, my assets has been increasing from 80 to 100. So it really depends on when we look at this issue, which perspective we are looking at. We are looking at the reporting entity of A, acquire, so there are no any economic substance changes. So this is underlying why a lot of companies and users favor precedent approach, because there is no economic substance change. It's still, the asset is still there. It's no change, still $180. There are no value increase. But if another party outside of the family buy that asset, pay 100 consideration, the value really we increase, because we make money between the family with outside. So this is the basic underlying concept why most of the companies stand setter and users favor the precedent approach.
But if you go to slide 12. And the focus isn't on P, which is the whole family. The focus is only on A, which is one of your brothers, and I can't remember which brother, who bought the other brother.
The older brother.
The big brother is
Big brother bought the little brother? Okay. So now, why would A care how much P valued the little brother at if he's just bought the big brother or whatever it is?
Yeah.
You know what I'm asking you. Because I agree with you, if my focus is P, nothing's changed. But we're trying to account for what A's done.
Yeah. So...
Getting excited here?
Yeah. Just this, I don't want to not jump the queue, but I just want to make sure I understand this. If we're looking at this thing now, I'm going back to 12, where A is holding 30%, and B owns 100% of C, and A pays B some premium over the carrying value. So what's happening is P is paying 70% of that excess, and the other folks are paying 30%. And so the higher that is, the more that, and P's receiving. Right? So doesn't that sort of start to matter in that the higher that is, the more that P's basically taking money from the other folks?
But we still look at entities at A's perspective. So the question is, what does versus what doesn't matter for the users of financial statements of entity A? We're not talking about the users of financial statements.
Yeah, I'm just going back to this example of the sons. Is and people saying it doesn't matter to P. It matters a lot to P. If you've transferred resources from A to B. And P owns 70% of A and 100% of B, P is collectively better off.
Okay.
So it matters to P. I have no accounting, but it matters to P.
Okay,
is
but
that not right?
It is right, but also for P. What can happen for P in this scenario? Essentially, a transaction with NCI. This is sort of the economic effect that P could either sort of give to non-controlling shareholders or take away, like in theory, but such transactions are already covered by IFRS. There is no sort of scope exclusion for P. The only scope exclusion which we have to deal with is for entity A. So we're not saying that nothing happens for P. Sometimes it might have an effect, but there is no scope exclusion in existing standards.
So these effects is already covered.
Yeah.
Nick?
Thanks, Hans. I just want to go back to slide 23 and really focus on entity A and the users of information for entity A. Try and tease out from their perspective the implications of going down the predecessor route opposed to the acquisition route. And Sue mentioned goodwill, but I think it's more than that, because I think if you go down the acquisition route, you'd have to recognise intangibles, stage brands, customer relationships, which you'd then have to amortise. So in terms of what the user would see between the two methods, just taking these assumptions, and there may be lots of other things going on, you would certainly see higher profits under the predecessor method compared to the acquisition method, because you'd have no intangibles that you'd be amortizing under the predecessor method. And I suspect that's why lots of companies are going down the predecessor method. In both cases, there's no difference in cash flows, but you will have a distinct difference in earnings. So I'm just trying to tease out why companies may be going, is this part of the reason?
Margaret, this is one of the hang-ups, I think.
Yeah, sorry.
It'll come back regularly.
Time and time again, I'm afraid.
Françoise?
Exactly as you have said, I mean, I would like to understand why we should not go to the method of acquisition. For A, when we're looking at A and the needs of the users of A, when the economics of A have changed exactly as they change when this combination occurs between two parties which are unrelated. So I really would like to have the acquisition method challenged in terms of its effects, its operability, before we say we need something else.
Turnbull.
Thank you. On page 22, the feedback of users. If you see your good summary paper of 23A, if you see paragraph 28, There is a very interesting explanation on your feedback from users. I'm just a little confused with this summary and the sentence of the page, slide 22.
Which paragraph, Chung Wu?
28 of paper 23A.
Paragraph 28.
There are many users who specifically commented on the IPO scenario, blah, blah, blah. They would like to have all assets and liabilities should be measured at fair value for a book value. In the case of they would like to have all assets and liabilities at fair values, is that those users are asking you us to consider a fresh start counting?
From memory, it wasn't the sort of idea or the request to look at fresh start. Did not really come from users. And the key point we are trying to make in this paragraph, that if you have a scenario which is actually similar to the one described on slide 9, so you have a private group, there are a few entities, and then these entities go to an IPO. So what people would like to avoid is a situation where, depending who buys whom, you get some of the acquired assets at fair values. Oh, sorry, let me start. Some of those assets which went to IPO at fair values and other at historical values. So they're saying either the entire sort of group that goes for an IPO should be at historical carrying amounts, or everything should be at fair value, but you shouldn't do, you know, pick and do some at fair values and other at historical. So that's the main point we're trying to make in paragraph 28.
I don't want to cut off the discussion, but we have a lot of slides left. And it's not that we can go a little a bit over time.
This discussion has made me realize that I think we need to think about a different kind of scope decision for this project. I think we can view it either as, in effect, a maintenance project to address diversity in practice, where we are not doing any or very limited conceptual deliberations of, you know, what clean sheet of paper, what's the best thing. It's bigger than I want to ask the interpretation committee to do, but I think we'd have to discipline ourselves to kind of act in that type of mode where we're not doing fundamental reconsiderations, or I think we consider things more broadly. And that, you know, I think the first option that I described might run counter to some of the things I was saying before about doing a technical analysis of fresh start accounting. Because what I have realized from this discussion is if we answer this on a conceptual basis, I think we're finally going to have to answer the question as a board about whether a subsidiary's financial statements are a slice of the group, or whether you look at the subsidiary's financial statements as a standalone, regardless of the entity by the group. And the board has flip-flopped, you know, the boards over time have flip-flopped on that conceptual question. If you look especially at some of the specific answers we've given in the area of employee benefits in a subsidiary, we've said you should regard the subsidiary as a slice of the parent and therefore take a piece of the group's carrying value. And I think there are other places where we've done that. And so I think we've had different perspectives, and we should be conscious that that question is out, you know, is floating out there. So one thing the staff might want to think is whether they say we want to come back to the board and treat this as an implementation addressing diversity in practice without redeliberation of concepts, or whether they want, you know, conceptual conclusions to these things, which would, I think, provide a longer duration answer, but would be, I think, a more difficult project.
Just responding a little bit to what Nick and Sue said earlier, I hope this doesn't come across too much like a confession, but In my past life, I did a lot of predecessor accounting. That was something we regularly used. That wasn't conceptual and wasn't profit-related, purely operational. By doing it, you saved yourself the need for a detailed valuation, and you saved yourself having to maintain two sets of records, the underlying acquisition price and the original price. And that was, for us certainly, it was a significant, if not the only reason behind doing it that way.
Gary?
Daryl just said 90%. No, Daryl said 90% of what I was going to say is this is all driven by P. I mean, and P operates in P's interest, which is easier, less work, and so on. But the one thing I do want would add to it is you might very well, for your IFRS or GAAP books, get predecessor accounting. There will be cases in your tax books you actually get a step up in basis, and then you got to deal with deferred taxes and so on. I mean, it's got to be a substantive transaction as opposed to window dressing, but again, I'm not thinking we should put that into this project. We'll never get done. And actually, I would second Mary's comment is really the scope. Is this just eliminate diversity in practice? And I certainly wouldn't start making this a bigger project until the PIRs on 10, 11, and 12 are done, and that's going to be some period out.
Thank you. Just quickly, the difficulty of this project is we didn't have this standard for 10 years, even after we have the IFRS 3. So the local practice has developed in each jurisdiction, which is mainly covered by regulators. And then the one of the big issues of this project is how we can protect shareholders of NCI. Because I have an impression that predecessor method is somehow overused. And the most dangerous point is if the P level company is not a consolidated company like a private person, then even if Mary said it's a slice of the parent level, then no information is available. So then if A level, if predecessor method was used, then the accounting is quite odd, like Sue pointed out. So then that is the most important point. NCI, shareholders of NCI, is not really protected. So my question to the research is, so I understand the predecessor method is prevailing. It's handy. However, from the viewpoint of NCI's protection, what kind of view does each regulator have? And how can we protect NCI? That is the research point we need to scrutinize. Thank you.
Okay. Please continue.
So I'll go quickly on slide 24. This is like we try to outline the decision process that the board will need to go through. As I said, the main question is which method should be applied to transactions within the scope, and there are two different possibilities. Either to choose one single method for all transactions or to choose different methods depending on the characteristic of each transaction. And in this case, the board will need to also answer two different sub-questions, so which method to choose and how to draw the line, so which method to apply to which transaction. And of course, we will present a paper on the alternative method discussing exactly this decision process. I will quickly go through the topic two to save some time. And topic two is deal with the question surrounding the application of the predecessor method and why we decided to further explore this method. This is linked to the fact that, okay, it seems to be commonly used in practice, and secondly, because the acquisition method is already fully described in IFRS 3, so there are no uncertainty on how it's applied, whereas for the predecessor method, we receive a feedback saying that there are a lot of diversity in practice on how this method is applied. So at least participants to our outreach confirmed that the difference between the consideration transfer and the net asset acquired is always accounted for in equity, so referring to what Mary said before, but there are still diversity in practice in what carrying amount to use, from which day to combine entities, and how to present comparative information, the measurement of the consideration transfer, and where in equity to recognize the difference between the consideration and the acquired net asset. On slide 30, we outline all this sub-questions, so application question, say, on how the predecessor method should be applied. And what we would like to highlight here is that the trickier question are definitely the first two, so which carrying amount to use and how to deal with comparative information. The third question, so regarding how to measure the consideration transfer, is less controversial, but it might have some implication, especially when the acquirer transfer an asset as a consideration instead of just cash or issue share. While regarding the last one, so the where in equity to recognize the difference, this is really a matter commonly addressed by local legislation, and moreover, the board does not generally prescribe where in equity to present the difference. So what we are going to do now is mainly...
I suggest, in the interest of time, maybe let's see, I think Mary has a comment, and just do a very quick recap in terms of sort of what's happening next.
I have two observations on slide 30. The first is about the first one and carrying amounts. I believe that we may be dancing around the issue of what's called, at least for U.S. practice, push-down accounting, whether or not you take, let's say, carrying value adjustments that sit at the parent level and include them in the carrying values. It's not that we shouldn't touch it, but it might help at times to refer to it because people would understand that that's the issue that we're talking about. And there is a lot of developed U.S. guidance around push-down and how it happens. I'm not saying we should automatically incorporate it, but it might save some time reinventing the wheel to get some codifications of that and understand what the issues are that have been addressed. The other is in terms of differences. I agree with you that we generally don't prescribe in equity, but one of the things that we do prescribe in equity is when things are recognized in OCI versus other categories of equity, and we just might want to be clear because that in or out of OCI is a significant distinction that is one that we make typically. So let's not almost create diversity by saying we aren't weighing in on that. That does seem to open up that possibility.
Okay, and so maybe just quickly recap what is happening next. So the first order issue that we look at is the scope of the project and which transactions should be in this scope. And second of all, and again, this is all for the purposes of issuing a discussion paper. So the second question is, okay, which alternatives should be discussed in the discussion paper in terms of which method is applied from methods to transactions within the scope? And it might be that just one method is applied to all transactions within the scope, while maybe the board will conclude that there is no reason not to use the acquisition method, or maybe there is a combination of different methods. And then any method other than the acquisition method that we would like to describe in the discussion paper, we would also need to look at how this method should be applied. So if it is a predecessor method, how it should be applied, and to include alternatives in the discussion paper, do we include a preliminary view? So these are the questions that we will look at in the coming months.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Quick end.